to rhrealitycheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Michael Kaufman about what guys can learn about feminism. Operation Rescue creates a boldly threatening website against abortion providers, and Anderson Cooper does a show on purity balls. Sad, but not surprising news. Gabrielle Giffords is stepping down from the House of Representatives.
I don't remember much from that horrible day, but I will never forget the trust you place in me to be your voice. Thank you for your prayers and for giving me time to recover. I have more work to do on my recovery, so to do what is best for Arizona, I will step down this week.
We had an opportunity as a country to talk about the problem of politicized violence after her shooting, and it was destroyed by epic levels of defensive whining on the right. My next segment will show why shutting up was a bad idea. But for now, I want to wish Representative Giffords all the best in her recovery. Operation Rescue's people like to get all huffy and take offense when you point out that their organization is somewhere on the continuum of racketeering and terrorism, since their main goal is to intimidate abortion providers. After all, having extremist anti-choice protesters picket your clinic rapidly raises the chance of violence against the clinic, or in many sad cases, against the people who work there. As we learned with the death of Dr. George Tiller in 2009, or the recent clinic arson in Florida. Because of this, Operation Rescue Plain Innocent doesn't fly. They know very well what they're doing when they target clinics and doctors, sicking unstable people on them. Rachel Maddow explained how, in the pre-internet days, posters were created with detailed information about doctors and distributed.
This is the pattern. Detailed wanted posters going up, the distribution of exact addresses and descriptions and photos and other specific information about a doctor, these posters distributed by anti-abortion extremists, and then the doctor gets assassinated. This is the pattern that they have well established over a number of years. We interviewed a doctor in North Carolina a little more than a year ago who told us that he feared for his life after the same tactic was used against him. The poster with photo and address and other detailed information for a doctor who provides abortion services, this is a tried and true means of intimidation for the extreme anti-abortion movement. And because of all these past instances of the distribution of that kind of personal information about a doctor being followed by an extremist using violence against that doctor, this is a form of intimidation that has well earned its intended terroristic effect.
And now, in the digital age, they've managed to take the intimidation strategy to a whole new level.
Now, Operation Rescue, a long-standing anti-abortion extremist group, is taking this technique nationwide. Operation Rescue has launched a new website, a database of detailed searchable information about doctors who provide abortion services. Photos, addresses, handy maps to find their place of business. The website describes every doctor, or at least aims to describe every doctor who provides abortion in the United States, and describes them as part of a cartel. The generic clip art photo for doctors for whom they don't have photos yet is this picture of somebody in handcuffs. The basic idea to their extremist anti-abortion followers is, go get them. Here's how.
She reports that the Feminist Majority Foundation has already made claims about this to the federal law enforcement. Threats like this have been found in the past to be violations of the FACE Act, which was passed to prevent anti-choice terrorism. I am particularly incensed that they have pictures of people in cuffs standing in for abortion providers they don't have actual pictures of. That implies to many unstable people who are invested in this that abortion is somehow not quite legal, and that killing a doctor would be a form of vigilante justice. In fact, it's just plain terrorism. If you balk at the word terrorism, let me read the FBI definition for you. Quote, Domestic terrorism is the unlawful use or threatened use of force or violence by a group or individual based and operating entirely within the United States or Puerto Rico without foreign direction, committed against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives, end quote. The detailing of names, addresses, and identifying features after repeated violence constitutes a threat, in my opinion, and in the opinion of any reasonable person. The intent here is to intimidate a civilian population in furtherance of the political goal of preventing safe legal abortion. The Young Turks had a great segment where they spelled this out for anyone who still isn't seeing how this is terrorism.
And basically, you know, they're saying, look, we're not trying to incite violence or anything. We're just trying to hold these doctors accountable, and we're giving everyone a resource to know who these abortionists are.
Yeah, I want everybody at home to think about this, right? Imagine if a Muslim fundamentalist did a group list and they said, oh, well, we're just putting the names of people we don't like, maybe who did Muhammad cartoons or whatever, and we're telling you where they live because we want people to hold them accountable. How much would the country flip out, Anna?
The country would definitely flip out. We wouldn't stop hearing about it. It would be on Fox News 24/7.
Part of the problem is that Operation Rescue members don't look like what Americans are trained to think of when it comes to terrorists. They're mostly white, they're all Christian, and they're fond of fanny packs. But what we think a terrorist looks like should be expanded to fit who terrorists actually are.
And it's not like pro-life fundamentalist extremists haven't done violence. They've killed abortion doctors. They've done assassinations.
Yes.
They've literally done terrorism. This is an outrageous story.
Absolutely. You know, in this country right now, we have an issue with right-wing extremism. But right now, the government is ignoring that in order to basically tackle this non-existent problem of Muslim terrorism in the country. It's ridiculous.
Right. It's not that both problems aren't relevant. It's that actually right-wing extremism is larger,
yes.
But unfortunately it doesn't get anywhere near the attention.
Cenk is right that Muslim terrorism is a genuine problem. But it's one thing that's kept in check because the government takes it seriously. Often, too seriously. Breaking human rights laws, etc. No one is asking that the government do that in this case. What we're asking for is current law to be enforced. The FACE Act currently forbids threats of violence to interfere with reproductive health services, which I think we can all see this is. The maximum penalty should be $10,000 or 6 months in prison. I would like to see the people behind this face the proper charges and receive the appropriate punishments. I'd like to welcome Michael Kaufman to the program. Michael is one of the two Michael Kays who wrote the new book, The Guy's Guide to Feminism, with the other being Michael Kimmel. Michael Kaufman is an educator and writer focused on engaging men and boys to promote gender equality and to end violence against women. He's the co-founder of the White Ribbon Campaign, one of the largest efforts in the world of men working to end violence against women, and the author and editor of six books on gender issues. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Michael.
Great to be with you today.
So, I'll be honest, I've long thought that this is the kind of book that needed to be written, mainly because men far more often than women come up to me and ask for a how-to guide when it comes to being a feminist. Is that like a thing? Do men more than women really want a simple how-to-be-a-feminist guide? If so, why?
Well, I think there's several reasons why we wrote this book. One is, as you know, the media has done such a good job, and the right wing has done such a good job in distorting what feminism is and just vilifying even the word feminism. And so one of the things that always strikes us, and I'm sure it strikes you, is the number of people who will, if you go through issue by issue, an agenda of women's equality, most women and men will say, I agree, on most issues anyway. But then you get to the last question, so you're a feminist or you're a pro-feminist. They'll say, oh, no, of course not. So one of the things we want to do is just let's go through the issues and say this is what it looks like. But to do it in a way that's aimed at men. This isn't about two men defining what feminism is. That obviously wouldn't be appropriate. It wouldn't make sense. But it is about men listening to what women have been saying in words and deeds and writing for decades now, and reflect that to men. you know, we do feel that men's lives are changing. And one of the reasons they're changing is that now for a couple of generations, we've lived in a culture of increasing gender equality. And not only does that mean huge changes for women, but it also means huge changes for men. And both Michael and I have been convinced for a long time that those changes are actually good. I mean, sure, it means men giving up forms of power and forms of privilege that we've enjoyed as men, but it holds out to us an enormous range of possibilities that in the past men have, I guess you could say, denied ourselves. So what we wanted to do in this book was to create not just an accessible, but a fun book aimed at men that talks about these issues of gender equality, of feminism, so men can really make sense of it and understand things.
So what was there any kind of question about how to title the book? Because I know that, like you said, the F word is always a very big block for a lot of people.
Yeah, we did go through a lot of discussions on that. You know, the purpose of a title is to get people to read a book. So you're trying to draw people into it, and I think it's true. I think there are those who'll say, you know, this isn't a book for me because it had that word in the title. But in the end, we just said, let's just call it what it is, but also let's do it in a way that tries to signal this is going to be fun. It's certainly guy friendly. And, I mean, I say it's going to be fun. There's certainly many entries that you don't write. I don't write about violence against women or sexual assault and in any way make it fun. I mean, there are entries in this book. It's an A to Z book, and there are entries in it that are just plain serious. But where possible and where appropriate, we make it fun. I mean, there's fake interviews, and there's recipes, and there's spoofs on ads. And we just try to make this as accessible as possible. And with knowing full well that, yeah, there's going to be some guys who are scared away by the title. But, you know, guys are supposed to be tough and be able to take it and be honest. Well, let's appeal to that quality.
So what would you say is, like, the target audience for this book?
Well, I think we particularly had young men in mind, you know, anywhere from mid-teens well into their 30s as the principal audience in terms of some of the images and language we use. That much said, it's been really wonderful to hear from such a range of men since the book came out in November. Men in that age group, quite a few, but also men in their, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. I got an email from someone who, by his references, it sounds like he's in his 80s, but also from someone who works with young men, with boys, basically, in their early teens, who says, you know, this is a book that he wants them to read as well. So, you know, I think in different ways it appeals to quite a range of men.
So I'm constantly getting questions from guys about feminism, usually more concerns about towing some feminist line, and they tend to be, like, really legalistic. So yeah. I'm interested in your take on some of these questions. First, what do you say to guys who are worried about where the line is when it comes to drinking and or doing drugs and sexual consent? I find a lot of guys are, like, really hysterical and think they're going to get charged with rape for sex with someone who's had, like, two drinks.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that, you know, that has been very important in my own work, I speak on a lot of college campuses, and one of the things that I do a lot of it is speak about the nature of consent. Because there is so much confusion. I mean, you know, people saying you need a lawyer present when you, you know, hook up with someone and all that. One of the things that we do in the book is we have four rules of consent. And we try to boil down consent into some very clear principles. And we use a lot of analogies. I mean, for example, on drinking and sex, we use the analogy with drinking and driving. And, you know, we talk about how, you know, you can be just get behind the wheel of a car, and if you're over the legal limit, you can be arrested for drunk driving, even if you're not driving. That's because we know that if you've been drinking, you cannot give or get informed consent. So we talk about these things in terms of respect, in terms of common sense, but also in terms of people protecting themselves. from things that, that they know they shouldn't be doing. So yes, on consent, for example, we have some really, I think really clear rules of consent. You know, we talk about how it's your responsibility. You're being both a woman and a man, whether it's a male-female, female-female, male-male relationship, how it's each person's responsibility to know they have consent, not just assume it, but to know it, and how you do that. And, of course, that's in a larger context in the book where we talk about listening as a key part of feminism for men.
So another question I get asked a lot is, but how do you, like, have sex if you can't objectify women?
Well, I guess there's lots of different ways, aren't there? You know, I don't think that sex is about objectifying. I think sex is our capacity to get pleasure from the human body. I could make a joke about other people's sexual preferences, you know, sex is our ability to, unless you're into ducks or something, it's our ability to get pleasure from the human body, from our own bodies and from the body of someone else. And, you know, in that sense, the person that we're with, whether it's a woman or a man, the person we're with, you know, you could say is an object of our desire. That's true. But is also a sexual subject, because if they're only an object, if they're only, you know, like a plastic blow-up doll, you're basically masturbating. And so one of the things that we do in this book is we celebrate sexuality, we celebrate sex. This isn't, and I think that certainly one of the things that we've learned from feminism over the years, that this isn't an anti-sex sort of movement. This is about the celebration of desire and human possibility, and including the assertion by women of women's own sexuality and the desire by women to express that in ways that they want to express it without being defined by men. So what we say is that, yes, you could say that someone might be an object of desire, but that's different from objectifying. Because when we say objectifying, that means reducing them to only, you know, this sort of physical cutout. And one of the things that I've heard from so many men over the years is that these images of who is supposed to be desirable to us really doesn't work. It's a bit of a stereotype, not only of women and of supposed desirability, but in a different way, it's also a bit of a stereotype of men. You know, that all we care about is a certain set of attributes, and we couldn't care less what sort of human being there is there. So, yes, this is about celebrating sexuality, sexual possibility, sexual choice, sexual decision-making, sexual diversity, all, of course, within the ambit of consent.
If there was one thing that you could get guys to talk about more when it comes to discussing feminism, masculinity, gender, any of that, what would it be?
Well, I think that one of our starting points has just got to be forms of violence against women. You know, I think that one of the ways that we are engaging a lot of men around the world is on questions such as fatherhood. We're seeing a massive change in our society and around the world in men becoming much more active as fathers than before. More and more men seeing it as a key part of their life. More and more men seeing fatherhood as something that as parenting as something that needs to be shared equally. You know, that is, men shouldn't just be helping out or babysitting, but it's if we're a parent, that's our job. So, you know, there are amazing changes around fatherhood, but I think that if there's one issue that we really got to pay immediate attention to, it really has to be the issue of gender-based violence. We live in a world, and this has been really my primary focus for the past 20 years. We live in a world that is just inundated with forms of violence against women. You know, most violence in the world is committed by men, either against women or against other men. And so, you know, when it comes to parts of the feminist agenda and concerns, boy, we've got to pay real attention as quickly as possible to sexual assaults, to sexual harassment, to murder, to honor killings, to rape as a weapon of war, to physical violence, to emotional violence and financial control. I mean, there's a lot there. And I think that, you know, we live in a society in which the majority of men don't do those things. The majority of men don't commit rape. The majority of men don't hit their girlfriend or wife. But sadly, until recently, the majority of men have been silent about those forms of violence. And by being silent, we allow that violence to continue. So one of the things that we advocate strongly in The Guy's Guide to Feminism, and certainly has been part of the work of both of the authors, is a very strong voice by men and boys speaking out against the violence, looking at our own beliefs and challenging the guys around us, but also looking at not just the acts of violence, but the underlying attitudes that make the violence possible. I don't buy that men are born to kill, to hurt. I don't buy that, you know, just having a higher amount of testosterone in our bodies makes us natural born killers. But, you know, I do know that if you have a society that has traditionally valued men more than women, have given us more power, in which men have taken on forms of privilege, in which we've been silent about the violence, I think it really sets up conditions for men to disproportionately use violence in our lives. So I think if there's one issue that we've really got to speak out about and address right away are the many different forms of men's violence against women.
My guest today has been Michael Kaufman. You can learn more about The Guy's Guide to Feminism at guysguidetofeminism.com. They have excerpts and they have links where you can buy the book. It makes an excellent gift. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Michael.
Great speaking with you today. Thanks so much for all of your work.
If you want to be thoroughly weirded out, I find no better way to accomplish your bewildering goal than to delve into the world of purity balls. These are father-daughter events where there's a lot of dressing girls in white and talk of fathers, well, basically owning their daughters. And that ownership, which is portrayed by the advocates of purity balls as some kind of love, is confirmed by girls pledging their virginity to their fathers. No, not to take, though that's an understandable subtext to this. The fathers merely own their virginity for purposes of giving it away to the man they deem worthy of taking ownership of their daughters by marrying them. Fathers are to virginity like car salesmen are to new cars. They own the cars and preserve them for someone else to use. When they transfer ownership, the new owner actually gets to use the car, which is exciting for them, but reduces the value of it as soon as they drive it off the lot. It's an easy-to-understand transaction. Of course, in this case, the object being transferred is an actual human being, but let's face it, Christian conservatives don't really think of women as full human beings in the way that they think men are. Anderson Cooper did a show on purity balls, and it was full of shudderingly creepy stuff. What was amusing was how the defenders of purity balls kept insisting that purity is about more than virginity, even though literally all they talk about during this purity ball nonsense is how a father's success as a father is measured by whether or not he provides his son-in-law with a virgin bride.
Commitment made, it's their own commitment. It's not something that is forced upon them. It's something that they desire and wish to do.
And the purpose of the balls is what? The purity balls?
The main purpose is to have a public expression of that commitment and also to have the gathering of the complete support system. Other young ladies, fathers, uncles, grandfathers.
It looks a little bit like a wedding. I mean, you are walking down the aisle with your daughter.
I love how he thinks that using the word commitment a lot changes anything. It's a commitment to virginity. The support system is there to make sure you keep your virginity. You can bandy the word choice around all you want, but the fact remains is that girls who don't have fathers deeply interested in controlling them don't choose purity balls. he actually paints a picture of all the men of a family gathering around the young virgin and making it clear that her virginity is of critical importance to them and that they personally feel like they own and control her sexuality. I'm a little unclear how the word choice has any value when all the men in your family are surrounding you with a bit of comply or else energy. But one strategy that abstinence weirdos employ to deflect criticism is by getting the girls themselves to get all misty about the whole thing. They think this is killer stuff, though, of course, they get the buy-in of little girls and young teenagers through nefarious means.
My dad is my best example of a perfect man that I want because he raised me and he's shown me unconditional love. He's loved me even when I throw temper tantrums or when I have a bad day and just slam my backpack on the floor and march through the house and shut my door and don't talk to him. But he's always been there for me to talk to. Like, I go to my dad sometimes when I don't understand a situation because he's been there. He's been a teenage boy.
It's really upsetting to me that these men are telling their daughters that their relationship to future husbands should be identical to that of your relationship to your father, especially the one you had when you were a little girl. You know, when your dad could send you to your room for misbehaving and tell you to eat your veggies? So, yes, this is about more than virginity. It's about teaching young women that because they are women, they will never be full adults. Instead, they will be overgrown children that their husbands get to have sex with. Gross. It's easy to see why the girls buy into this stuff, though. I was a virgin at 15, too, and sex seemed distant and scary. It's not that uncommon. But what's messed up is telling young people that how they feel about anything, be it sex or their love of boy bands, is how they're going to feel for the rest of their lives, and then creating a massive guilt trip if they actually, gosh, start to mature. I mean, they even wear poofy white wedding dresses, and let's face it, they're play marrying their fathers, which is so gross. And these dresses are straight out of the catalog of what little girls think princesses wear, and very different from the sleek and sexier dresses that most actual grown-up brides wear. Luckily, Jessica Valente was on dropping some wisdom.
Well, I don't want to say anything's wrong with them. I think the idea of a father-daughter relationship and a father-daughter event is really lovely and I think much needed. My concern is that we're fighting sexualization with more sexualization. I think a lot of the purity balls, the purity trend, is in response to kind of the hypersexualization of pop culture, the sexualization that we see of younger and younger girls, and that's a real concern that a lot of parents have. My worry is that by having kind of virginity pledges and purity balls, you're focusing so much on girls' virginity that you're still sexualizing them. I think if we want to teach our daughters to be good people, let's teach them to be good people. Their sexuality has nothing to do with that.
So Jessica, your point is that by putting the emphasis on virginity, on quote-unquote purity, however you define that, it still is putting, it's sending the wrong message to a young woman. And it's also sending a message to somebody maybe who has had sex that they're somehow impure.
It's still putting an emphasis on women's sexuality as the basis of who they are and how good they are rather than their compassion, their kindness, their courage, their integrity. And yes, you know, when you say, well, virgins are pure, then what does that mean for those of us who aren't virgins, that we're impure, that we're damaged, that we're dirty? So that's really my worry. And I think there's a lot of really wonderful ways that people can bond with their dads without kind of bringing sexuality into the conversation.
It's clear that we're working with different versions of the phrase good people here. Jessica and I see women's goodness like men's. Are you an honest person, a hard worker, kind to others, takes care of responsibilities? But the Christian right sees a woman not so much as a person, but an object for sale. They imagine women like little kids imagine toys, as somehow more valuable because it's still in the original wrapping. The internal life of women is of no consequence to them, just their value as objects to be owned and controlled. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. That word does not mean what you think it does edition. Anti-choicers continue their mission of demeaning Jews and others who died in the Holocaust by suggesting their lives were equivalent of mindless embryos the size of quarters. This time, it's Andrew Napolitano of Fox News.
How scary is this? the Supreme Court declares a class of humanity not to be persons and then permits people to destroy members of that class. That's what happened to blacks during slavery. That was the philosophical argument underlying the Holocaust. That's what's happening to babies in the womb, even as I speak.
Actually, he is right that someone's humanity is at stake here, but it's not the embryos and the very occasionally fetuses that are killed during abortion. The people whose humanity is at stake are women. That's why anti-choicers resist preventing cancer in women and providing abortion-preventing contraception at affordable prices. I've pointed this out before, but it's worth repeating. On the question of abortion, the Nazis actually sided with the American right. They tightened restrictions on abortion, and like the American right, they were deeply concerned that white Christian women weren't having enough children. Also worth noting that slave owners were big-time supporters of forced pregnancy as well, and openly treated slave women like breeding animals.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.